And Thursday, showers likely, highs 59 to 67. Thanks for choosing KAXE. Up next, As It Happens.
Hello, I'm Dave Seglins.
And I'm Talia Schlanger. Coming up on As It Happens.
Wars and words. A slew of U.S. news outlets is pushing back against a new policy at the Pentagon that aims to stop journalists from gaining access to the building unless they report only information authorized by the Department of Defense. The reporter tells us the implications are chilling.
And scrapple that, an unusual art competition sees sculptors using a pork scrap product called Scrapple to bring their creations to life. One such artist tells us about getting his hands dirty for his art.
Those stories and more coming up on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on KAXE. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Let's sample our album of the week. It is Hallelujah, Don't Let the Devil Fool Ya by Robert Finley. This is his fifth album, and after recording at least one gospel song on each of his previous albums, Finley fully leans into his faith and gospel music on this album. With an all-star band that includes members of the Black Keys, Heliocentrics, Budo's Band, and more, the sound remains Finley's typical mix of rolling blues, swampy funk, sweet soul, and rock. You can let us know what you think. Text us 218-326-1234. This song from Robert Finley called On the Battlefield.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm Dave Seglin, sitting in for Neil Cooksell.
Good evening, I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
Pressing the Point, an unlikely collection of news organizations from across the political spectrum says new limits on their access to the Pentagon are a bridge too far, and covering war is starting to feel a bit like fighting one.
Keeping the Peace, a Palestinian analyst, says he's cautiously optimistic that the fragile ceasefire between Israel and Hamas can hold despite the difficult road ahead.
Extremely Vicious Cycle. A Northern Ontario First Nations leader declares a state of emergency as drug-fueled violence continues to rock local communities.
In Deep, a Newfoundland mayor pitches his small town as a new home for a group of beluga whales facing the prospect of euthanasia at a defunct amusement park.
A tall order. Derek the Donkey didn't seem made for international stardom, but he's taking his new record as the world's tallest donkey in stride.
And first comes the idea, then you flesh it out. We reach the winner of a Pennsylvania art contest that sees competitors make sculptures out of scrapple, which is a mush made of pork scraps. As It Happens, the Tuesday edition, radio that keeps you in the loop. Newsmax and NPR aren't typically aligned on much. The former is an unapologetically right-wing outlet run by someone routinely described as a friend and confidant of Donald Trump. The latter is a public broadcaster the U.S. president has derided as a liberal disinformation machine and worked to defund. Today, though, the two are united by their distaste for a pledge that U.S. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth is demanding all Pentagon reporters sign. Refuse, and they'll likely see their press privileges suspended. Tom Bowman's not waiting for that. In a column this morning, the veteran NPR reporter announced he's handing in his Pentagon press pass before anyone makes him. We reached Mr. Bowman in Washington, D.C.
Tom, if you were to have signed this so-called pledge, what would you have been agreeing to exactly?
Basically, I can't solicit information from Pentagon employees. I can't reach out to them and ask them what's going on. I have to basically wait for the Pentagon to release any information, even unclassified information. So basically, it bars a reporter from reporting.
What are some of the stories that you've been able to cover over the years, thanks to the editorial freedoms that you now see being curtailed?
Well, one of the great things was we were able to treat the Pentagon, which is a massive building, the biggest office building in the world, as basically City Hall. We could go pretty much anywhere we wanted to in the building. You would run into people. I could run into, let's say in the past, Petraeus or General Milley walking down the hallway and just chat them up. What's going on? Not asking for classified information, but just basically, what are you hearing out there? What should we be focused on? What we're not focused on? We just heard X, Y, and Z. Does that sound right to you? And basically just chat them up like you would if you're walking through City Hall in any city in Canada or the United States. During the Iraq War, when Baghdad fell, and I was at a briefing with Defense Secretary Rumsfeld, and he talked about the fall of Baghdad, this whole Iraq invasion is a big success. You know, it's a big win for the United States. And it was, you know, really pretty impressive. So I was walking down the hallway and almost ran into this army officer I know. I said, hey, great news, right? Baghdad fell. He said, no, Tom, it's not good news. They didn't tell you what's really happening there. That all these Saddam Hussein supporters called the Fedayeen, they're attacking our supply lines. So we have to send a lot of troops back to cover our supply lines. It's really a bad situation we're in now. And the reason we're in this situation is because Donald Rumsfeld refused to send enough troops to Iraq for this mission. And the only way I found out about that was I was able to walk down the hallways. So now if I solicited that information from that officer, they could pull my badge. Or I'm so restricted at the Pentagon now that I couldn't even walk down that hallway anymore. We're basically restricted to one hallway, which is the press area.
So, Tom, on the one hand, this is obviously troubling, the curtailing of the unauthorized access. And I, as a journalist, I totally get that. But on the other hand, I think a lot of our listeners might be surprised that you were ever allowed that kind of access to be strolling City Hall, as you say, and gathering unauthorized interviews and opinions. What do you think has stopped previous administrations from trying something like this?
I think part of it was the Pentagon is such an unwieldy place. There are 25,000 people who work there. There are contractors coming and going, people from Capitol Hill coming and going. I think they found it to be, it would just be problematic just to restrict some people and not other people. I think that was part of it. And I think some people, Pentagon officials I've covered over the years, even Don Rumsfeld, I mean, they kind of liked that engagement with the press or even seeing you in the hallway. You know, Rumsfeld would give me a hard time if he saw me in the hallway, kind of good-naturedly. So I think they kind of liked that give and take with the press. And the others had much more respect for the press than the current administration. They talk about fake news, which I find really grating. And then Defense Secretary Hegseth, it's been a turbulent time for him. There have been leaks about, disarray in his office, about him asking admirals and generals to go through polygraphs. So it's very embarrassing for him. And also, of course, he got involved in that Signalgate controversy. He was releasing highly classified information on the Signal chat group. And that information, remember, was about U.S. airstrikes on Yemen. Very highly classified information that if an enemy had picked that up, it could be disastrous. So I think part of it, he's embarrassed by some of the leaks. He's embarrassed by some of the questions he has from the press. And the other thing, he's only had two press briefings in 10 months. He just does not want to engage with the press unless he can go on a partisan news show like Fox and Friends and get softball questions from basically his old colleagues.
Pete Hegseth doesn't seem to be budging. I'm in social media when media organizations are tweeting out that they aren't going along with this. He's given the emoji wave. Can you see this administration changing its mind?
I don't know if he'll budge. And, you know, the other thing is, if he does go at some point, will the next person coming in maybe say, okay, we have to let the press back into the building? But we don't know if that's going to happen even. And it's important to note that we used to have offices right in the Pentagon. And now even those who sign this document, this restrictive document, they're not going to be allowed in the building itself. They'll only be able to work in this conference center, which is in a separate facility away from the Pentagon. And at this point, it's only One American News Network, that far right organization, that has signed the pledge. No other news organization has signed the pledge so far.
This all comes at a time of massive upheaval inside the Pentagon more broadly. President Trump renaming the Department of Defense the Department of War. He's recalled all the ranking military leaders from around the world to give political speeches. He's blowing up boats off the coast of Venezuela, declaring a quote.
He just blew up another one today, by the way.
He did. And yeah. What's the story that you fear may be lost in the face of this reduced access at the Pentagon?
Well, I think, first of all, we're not getting any information about what's going on behind the scenes. And again, this drug boat, this is the fourth one they blew up. They boarded a fifth. In the past, we would get some sort of background briefing about what you're doing, what weapon systems, how do you know that these are drug cartel boats, what's on board, what can you tell us? I mean, some of it's classified, but clearly you can tell us something about it. So we're not getting that kind of information. It's just really, really troubling. The American people should know what's being done in their name, how the money is being spent in their name, and more importantly, what is happening with their sons and daughters who go into harm's way.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks for your reporting.
You're welcome.
Tom Bowman is a Pentagon reporter for NPR. We reached him in Washington, D.C. It's only been a few days since a shooting rocked the Ganugaming First Nation in northern Ontario. One person was killed and another injured. The small community was put under a shelter-in-place order that has now been lifted, but it remains in a state of emergency, which was declared over a year ago because of violence and drug-related crime. Now the entirety of the Anishinaabe-Aski territory has entered a state of emergency. To curb violence in their communities, leadership declared the all-encompassing measure last Thursday in response to the shooting, which they believe to be drug-related. Alvin Fidler is the Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe-Aski Nation. We reached him in Thunder Bay.
Grand Chief Fidler, two shootings and shelters-in-place orders have happened to two Anishinaabe-Aski Nation communities in just a few days. There was the deadly one at Ganugaming, and on Sunday, another shooting left a person injured in a different community. How are people doing?
Well, our communities are on edge, and many are fearful for their own safety, and there's just a fear creeping into many of our communities that we have outsiders coming in. In some cases, taking over the communities, and by fear and by intimidation, and many of them are bringing in weapons into the communities.
You declared a state of emergency on Thursday across all of the Anishinaabe-Aski territories, but how long has this crisis been unfolding?
It's been in the making for some time. And we realize that it's complex, but I think what allows it to continue is just the government, whether it's Ontario or Canada's lack of proper response to the needs of our communities, including recognizing the authority of our leadership to be able to protect our own borders and to ensure that there's prosecution of those that that are caught, whether it's bringing in drugs into the communities or selling drugs to our community members.
What is it that could help? Is it more policing from, or more support for local policing? Is it military?
Well, we did, at our gathering last week, we did talk about a broad range of issues, including policing. And I think it's important to recognize that the crisis that that we're faced with right now is not just a policing issue, it's not just about law enforcement. There's a whole host of issues, I think, that that are at play, including, our communities dealing with historic trauma. And unfortunately, many of our communities, turn to alcohol and drugs as a coping mechanism, and that's contributing to what we are seeing on the ground. But I think, too, and I said this last week as well, that when we were planning this very important gathering, that we did invite officials from both Ontario and Canada, and for whatever reason, they chose not to come. And I think it's so important that if we're going to address these challenges head on in a collaborative manner, that our treaty partners, Ontario and Canada, are there, first of all, to listen to what our chiefs and our leaders are saying so that they can act on what is happening on the ground. And you can only learn, have a good idea what's going on if you're there to actually listen to the leadership that are on the front lines.
What do you make of their non-attendance?
I don't know. I think I have to ask them that. I don't know why they chose not to be here. It's disappointing for sure, because we know that communities cannot left to fend for themselves, that they don't need supports. For example, I was in Ganugaming on Friday, just before a long weekend, and there was just Chief Sherry Taylor and a couple of her council members sitting in the boardroom. And one of the first things that she told me is that she hadn't heard from anybody from the province. which was so disappointing that a leader like herself, who was in a really desperate situation, needs immediate supports. And I was able to get a hold of somebody from IUC, that's the Indigenous Services Canada, the federal department, to respond to, or to call her at least, which they did Friday afternoon. But this was 2 days after the shooting happened. And you know, the fact that no one from government had reached out to her was hugely disappointing.
Who are you most worried about in your communities?
I worry about our kids. I really do, because I know that you know, they're the most vulnerable, and I know that they know what's going on by social media. A lot of our children follow the news by social media, and I know that what they're hearing and what they're seeing is creating fear in their lives. And I worry about how this is impacting them. And this is what Chief Taylor and I talked about last week, that there needs to be, in the case of Gitogami, that there needs to be debriefing at the schools so that children can have a forum to express their fears or their concerns and to be given assurances that support is coming, that help is coming, so that they don't have to live in fear.
Now, we've spoken more than once over the years. You've been sounding the alarm for a long time now.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get tired of asking people to pay attention to this?
No, that's my job. You know, that's what I, you know, that's responsibility that I have as Grand Chief. And whether I'm tired or not tired, or, you know, it doesn't really matter. I think it's important that we keep raising our voices to ensure that the needs and the priorities and the concerns of our communities are heard loud and clear.
We'll leave it there. Grand Chief Fidler, thank you.
Thank you.
Alvin Fidler is the Grand Chief of the Anishinaabe Asque Nation. We reached him in Thunder Bay. We reached out to the Ontario Minister of Indigenous Affairs, Greg Rickford, for comment, but did not receive a response before airtime. Ceramics, marble, papier-mâché, scrapple. You probably know most of those sculpture materials, but I'll admit the fourth one, scrapple, is a bit esoteric. You'd probably only know it if you were truly up on art news. And there is big news in the scrapple sculpting world. On Friday, Philadelphia's Reading Terminal Market hosted its second annual Scrapple Sculpture Competition. And making art from the material is no easy feat, considering it's a food and it's made of mashed together pork scraps. Still, 12 competitors managed to put their work forward, and Pat Moser emerged as this year's champion. We reached him in Havertown, Pennsylvania.
Pat, congratulations. Have you had time to let this win sink in?
No. It's kind of bizarre, but it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of fun, actually. So it's been cool.
This is not exactly your typical art contest. So I have to start with a few basics here.
Mm-hmm.
What the heck is scrapple and how is it made?
Well, no one actually knows how scrapple is made. It's gray mystery meat. Mostly pork, I think.
Mystery meat, mostly.
Mystery
maybe
meat.
Don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm. We don't know. We don't question. We don't ask questions. We eat it.
I ask questions. How popular is it regionally?
Regionally, very popular. I mean, if I go to the diner, I mean that's my go-to for sure.
Really?
Mm,
so you're a fan.
It's the best. I love it. Yeah, it's the best. It's absolutely the best. It's, you know what? It's kind of divisive. You love it or you hate it. You're disgusted by it or it's life, you know?
Well, having tried it, I feel ashamed to say I'm a little disjointed by the thought of it.
Yeah.
What does it taste like?
Oh, man. Yo, Mike, what does Scrabble taste like, dude?
Salsa
Junior. We don't even know. It tastes like Scrabble, man. You know, it's like, what's chocolate if you've never tasted chocolate before?
All right, fair enough.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. It really is.
Now, you're talking to someone in your studio because you are a tattoo artist.
Yeah, I'm at work today. Yeah. All right.
You're a tattoo artist. About, you don't necessarily have a background in sculpting. A description of you at the competition read, quote, "Never sculpted, but fairly confident that I can handle a hunk of Scrapple." So what made you throw your name into this competition?
A buddy of mine, I'm a creative dude. So a buddy of mine sent me the link and I was just like, yeah, why not? Like my kids were at school that day. I had a little bit of time to go down to the Reading Market and try my hand at this. And lo and behold, I won, man. It was cool.
So your winning installation is called the Mush Push.
Yes.
A take on a football play known as the Tush Push. What were you trying to capture here?
I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do something like very like Philadelphia. Because I just figured that would help with my chances doing something local, something that everybody liked, something that was kind of us. But like, I was kind of thinking like Rodin, Caravaggio, like an old school, like real kind of bodies intertwined. It was a little overambitious, but there was enough time for me to kind of get it together, and it just worked out, man.
So paint us a picture.
Paint us a picture. So it was like super hard to kind of carve, but like I did the Eagles pushing Jalen Hurts over the end zone. You know, it's a winner. It's an absolute winner.
The Eagles and the Philadelphia reference football.
Mm-hmm.
I'm taking.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So since we're in Canada, for sure. So the Philadelphia Eagles, obviously, like, huge thing here. And the Eagles have a signature play that they use for short yardage that the rest of the NFL hates. But that's kind of our vibe here. You know, it's like, we don't care if anybody likes us. We're scrappy. We're trying to win. And I just thought it kind of worked with the medium.
So how successful do you think you were in creating your masterpiece?
I'd give myself a 7 out of 10. I needed more time, to be honest with you. I really could have used more time. I was, like I said, I was pretty ambitious. On my way in, my youngest son told me I should actually do a Tyrannosaurus Rex. And I almost switched it up to that just to make it simple, because it's not, Scrabble isn't meant for carving. It's not meant for sculpting, for sure.
It was a game time decision, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was watching the Eagles get beat by the Giants the night before. They ran the tush push over and over again. But and I was like, this is a terrible idea. The whole time I thought it was a bad idea. But
and what did the judges have to say? What did the judges say in the end?
Sasha Suda, she's the director and CEO of the art museum. She's a big deal, man. And she saw what I was doing there, I think, and she respected it and saw like the ambition as well as the technical application to the meat. And she called me the Michelangelo of meat, man. So, that, you know, it was quite an honor, to be honest with you.
Michelangelo, I love it.
Of meat, yes. Yeah. I don't know if she was talking about the artist or the turtle, but I'll take either.
Yeah. Is this what you would have guessed your claim to fame would be?
No. I didn't know I even had one, but I'll tell you what, man. My mom's pretty stoked on this, and I'm having fun with it, too. So,
any plans to defend your title next year?
Oh, yeah, I'll be back. My kids will be there, too.
Does this come along with endorsements and free supplies?
I've gotten nothing. I got a nice little trophy. I got a book. I got a T-shirt and a $100 gift card to the market, the Reading Terminal Market in Philadelphia. If you're ever traveling to Philadelphia, it's the best place. Every type of food vendor you could imagine. But, I mean, no, I've gotten nothing out of this beyond that. But there's been a lot of press, some wonderful comments on the internet, which is entertaining. So I'll take it.
Pat Michelangelo of Meat Moser, Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you so much. Thanks for calling me.
Bye for
now. All right. Take care. See you.
Pat Moser is a tattoo artist and the winner of this year's Scrapple Sculpting Competition in Philadelphia. We reached him in Havertown, Pennsylvania. I mean absolutely no offense when I say that, at first, Derek doesn't seem to have a lot going for him. And this is not me judging him. I would never. But those closest to him describe him as having no personality. That's a quote. He's also frightened of, let me see here. Oh, everything, including his own shadow. And I'm pretty sure that's literal fear of his literal shadow. He also lives at a donkey sanctuary in the UK, which isn't necessarily a red flag, but, you know, could be if he weren't a donkey. But he is. And things seem to be turning around for Derek. So now he's not only chock full of anxiety and drained entirely of personality, he is also a world record holder, standing 165 centimeters or 5'5" from hoof to withers. He is the tallest living donkey on earth. It's a title he earned upon the death of his uncle, the previous tallest living donkey, making Derek a bit of a Nepo Foley. But he's not letting any of that change him. He still looks down his nose at all the other donkeys as he's, you know, bolting away in fear, which is understandable after reaching such a dizzying height. Here's Antiphony with Such Great Heights.
I am thinking it's a sign that the freckles in our eyes are mirror images, and when we kiss, they're perfectly aligned. Corresponding shapes like puzzle pieces from the clay.
True, it may seem like a stretch, but it's thoughts like this that catch my troubled head when you're away and I am missing you to death.
Antiphony with their version of Such Great Heights.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, we will remember the trailblazing R&B singer D'Angelo for his pioneering neo-soul sound and his work alongside musical greats such as Lauryn Hill and Erykah Badu.
And Marc Maron signs off on his long-running podcast by sitting down with Barack Obama again. Stay tuned. I'm Talia Schlanger.
And I'm Dave Seglins.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 7 o'clock, John Henningsgaard, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Support comes from Clackow Brewing Company in Grand Rapids, making traditional old world styles of beer, as well as modern classics for 7 years now. Their taproom is open Monday through Thursday, 3 to 8, Friday and Saturday, noon to 8, Sunday, noon to 6. More info at clackowbrewing.com. Support also comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji. Since 2009, Boreal Brushworks has provided full-service interior and exterior painting services throughout northern Minnesota. More information about estimates and services at borealbrushworkspainting.com. Slight chance for showers this evening, then cloudy, lows in the low 40s. A mix of clouds and sun tomorrow with highs in the mid to upper 50s. We continue with As It Happens on KAXE.
It's been only days since the ceasefire in Gaza began, and cracks are already showing in the fragile peace. Israel declared today that Hamas had violated the truce by failing to return deceased hostages. In response, Israel limited the much-needed aid being let into Gaza. Yesterday, Hamas fighters publicly executed 8 people in a Gaza City square who they accused of collaborating with Israel. The next phase of the U.S.-backed peace plan calls on Hamas to completely disarm. It's a call the group has rejected. Tamer Karmaut is an associate professor in public policy from the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. We reached him today in Mexico City.
Tamer, how worried are you that we're already seeing cracks in this ceasefire?
Dave, I'm worried because this framework is still missing many technical details on the next stages. The fight and the killing has stopped. But now when it moves to the next phases and next stages, these are still missing many important details on how to achieve them. But so far, the momentum is still there. I mean, the signing of the agreement and the endorsement of the agreement in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh, took place only yesterday. And it has the endorsement of the U.S., key Arab allies, Turkey, important countries that play important roles in the region. So the momentum is there, but I would remain cautiously optimist.
I will ask you about those next stages, but Israel has said that Hamas has not complied with a key part of the first stage of the agreement, and that is the returning of the bodies of dead hostages. Is this going to be something that scuttles the ceasefire if it continues?
I mean, following the news, I've also listened to Hamas's response, and it makes sense because these are technical matters now. So when we're talking about recovering bodies of captives, you know, the war scene has changed the landscape of Gaza totally. I mean, entire neighborhoods have disappeared. I mean, people don't recognize their houses or their streets. So we would anticipate to face some technical difficulties in, per se, like Hamas finding the locations of these dead captives. It's a matter of time and technical efforts, and things could be resolved. The most important thing is the political will for the two sides to give it a chance and to provide more time for the mediators to solve these problems once they occur. And there will be many problems to occur yet in the future.
Among the next stages of the plan are calls for Hamas to completely disarm. How has the group responded to that requirement so far?
So this remains a very ambiguous part of the deal. And to my knowledge, we have not seen any document that lays out the details of this condition. What we know for sure is that Hamas has accepted to withdraw completely from the governance of Gaza. But what does this mean in technical and real terms? We don't know. We don't talk about Hamas only as a military party, because Hamas has been in governance for more than 18 years plus. So it was running health institutions, education institutions. It had its own collaboration frameworks with donors, with UN agencies. It was a de facto government on the ground. And it also has a large civil service apparatus. So dismantling Hamas from these aspects is a very complex process. And I'm not sure how things will go when it comes to this. I mean, we know that Hamas is committed to withdraw, but does this withdrawal meaning handing over all its weapons or just... So they have been using the term neutralizing Hamas's weapons. It means it's there, but it's not used in action, or keeping it with a third party, be it an Arab state or another entity, or getting rid of the heavy weapons and keeping the light weapons. We don't have clarity exactly on the details, the exact details of this proposal, and I think the mediators have yet to find a workable solution for it.
The words in the deal aside, you've been a longtime observer. What would need to happen to see Hamas actually go along with a disarmament plan?
That's a very good question, Dave. We are still missing the bigger or the larger problem, which is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. It's what's the end result of this political process of disarming Hamas and then reconstruction Gaza, if it doesn't lead eventually to the two-state solutions. So what I'm trying to say, what should happen now in Gaza, being it reconstructing Gaza or reforming the Palestinian Authority, possibly Hamas will remain, and it's not possible, I'm sure Hamas will not disappear as a political movement from Palestinian politics, because it's an ideology, it's an idea, and the mere existence of Hamas itself is an outcome of Israeli occupation. So what I'm trying to say is, all these small steps, major but small steps that happens in Gaza now, they have to be linked to a bigger strategy to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict once and forever, to revive the peace process, the dead peace process, and eventually that leads to two-state solutions. So if what's happening now is a fragmented effort focused only in Gaza and ignoring the bigger issue, the conflict, then I'm afraid it will be another wasted decade.
Fair enough, but I want to put one further observation from today's news to you. Hamas carrying out executions in the streets against what they were describing as Israeli collaborators. What does that tell you about Hamas leaders' frame of mind in this moment?
It's a very horrifying thing to see these extrajudicial executions happening this way, this horrific way. And I'm not justifying what Hamas is doing for sure, but I think it's trying to exercise its authority again in preparation for the next stages by saying or emphasizing that it remains a relevant actor in Gaza's politics, and it will not allow any competitors that don't impose from the outside to challenge its authority until it gets to the final arrangements of the deal. So that's a political message from Hamas. Of course, it's a horrific message, but again, this is the realities on the ground.
You were born in Gaza. On a personal level, what was it like, and how did it feel for you to see the fighting stop, at least temporarily?
It's a great sense of relief to see the killing stopping, but the misery continues, Dave. I mean, you're talking about a genocidal war that has changed the landscape of Gaza totally. More than 85% of the Strip has lost its infrastructure, huge losses in lives, disabilities, orphans, kids without families. The population, the civil population of Gaza have paid a tremendous price, and it deserves a moment of rest and long recovery and healing.
Tamer, we'll leave it there. Thank you.
My pleasure, Dave.
Tamer Karmaut is an associate professor in public policy from the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies. We reached him in Mexico City. After 16 years and close to 1,700 episodes, WTF is no more. Hosted by comedian Marc Maron, the podcast was an early breakout hit in the medium. He started out recording in his garage, speaking to fellow comics from unknowns to the likes of Robin Williams. Later, he branched out to musicians, actors, and authors. And in 2015, Barack Obama, the President of the United States at that time. Yesterday, in the pod's final episode, the former president returned as Maron's final guest with some words of advice for what comes next.
I feel okay. I feel like I'm sort of ready
right
for the break. But there is sort of a fear there of, what do I do now? I mean, I'm busy.
Right.
But not unlike your job. I'm right. going to compare my job to the presidency
yeah,
now.
Yeah, is that, I think it's pretty similar.
Thank you. I've got a lot of people who over the last 16 years have grown to rely on me.
Yes.
And
you've got a lot of fans just around.
Yeah.
And in unlikely places.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
As in here?
Yeah.
Yeah. The but like, you know, they need something.
Right.
That there is a feeling of like, how am I going to feel, you know, less alone? How am I going to deal with my mental this or that? And and how am I going to find, you know, a way to exist in the world that we're living in? I mean, I'm not offering them solutions, but I am commiserating. And it's comforting.
They trust you.
Yeah.
And they feel as if what you're going through and what they're going through occupies a similar space.
Right.
And so they don't feel like they're traveling this journey that can be frightening alone sometimes.
That's right.
And yeah, there's a power in the human voice, you know, that you grow attached to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when you left, what did you do for your mental health?
Somebody gave me advice right before I was leaving office. Uh-huh. And it was, don't rush into what the next thing is. Take a beat.
Uh-huh.
And take some satisfaction looking backwards and saying, you know what? Didn't get everything done that I wanted.
Right.
Wasn't always exactly how I planned it. But there's a body of work there that I'm proud of.
Right.
You know, pat yourself on the back for a second. Just be a little brain dead for a while. And then I think, you know, what this is an opportunity for you, it was an opportunity for me, was figuring out, all right, what's my next highest and best use? You know, what's a new purpose that scratches that itch? You know, but you don't have to rush into it. I guess my main thing would be, you know, take your time.
Right.
Unless you really got some bills to pay.
That was former U.S. President Barack Obama on the final episode of the WTF podcast with Mark Maron. The clock is ticking for a group of 30 beluga whales housed in what's left of Ontario's Marineland Zoo and Amusement Park. Following its founder's deaths, the park is quickly running out of money and didn't open to the public this year. And its operators say unless the remaining cetaceans can be rehomed, they may be forced to euthanize. Earlier this month, Canada's federal fisheries minister denied Marineland permission to export the belugas to a theme park in China, citing a 2019 law that banned keeping whales, dolphins, and porpoises for breeding or entertainment. Now, a community along Newfoundland's south coast is billing itself as an alternative. Trevor Green is the mayor of Burgio, Newfoundland and Labrador. That's where we reached him.
Mayor Green, what makes Burgio the right place for these belugas?
I think right now we have the right bay, I guess we'll call it. And it's not necessarily for all the belugas. Unfortunately, the bay is not big enough, but I think we could handle probably 8 to 10 of them. And it give them more of a natural habitat.
And to be clear, we're not simply suggesting setting them free. You're thinking of some kind of sanctuary that's cordoned off.
Yeah, and that's kind of my understanding right now. I don't call myself an expert in marine biology or anything like that at this point. I've had a few discussions with some different experts and stuff, and that seems to be the consensus. It would be to basically cage them in there temporarily, and maybe possibly is it possible over time that they'd be set free? I'm not 100% sure on that.
All right. Now, I know that there is some agreement that Burgio could be suitable for belugas in theory, but beyond that, things get a little trickier. I want you to hear some of the conversation that CBC had with scientist Hal Whitehead recently about these whales.
These are animals that are not capable of living by themselves in the wild. They've just lived in these concrete tanks for so long, and in many cases, all their lives. So they need to be looked after. And that is, you know, quite a complex business. It's not a cheap business. Money would have to be, you know, to build the pen, you'd need qualified vets to keep an eye on the animals. You need marine engineers to look after the nets and pens and so on. And then you need to feed them, and they eat quite a lot of food. I mean, that would probably provide good business for the local fishermen, but someone's going to pay for that food.
So even if it gets financial support, is Bergio really prepared to handle this kind of challenge?
Well, I guess really at the end of the day, it's the town itself is there will be a null. We're only a small town. We're about 1,100 people, so our income would not cover that. However, if we can get the financial backing and the right partnerships, that we do feel it would be something that could possibly be feasible. It is my understanding. These whales are, I mean, they're basically, you have to treat them like they are a pet. And that's really the only way. They don't know how to eat on their own. They don't know how to go look for food. So there's a lot of complicated passages to follow and talk to. And then, like I said, it's kind of up to the experts to kind of guide us and tell us, you know, is this feasible? Is this something you can do? And the financial backing side of it is the other side. You know, can we get somebody that's willing to take on this endeavor? Or, you know, is it something that the provincial and federal governments are looking at? I don't know.
Well, I know you wrote the federal fisheries minister, Joanne Thompson, about this. Provincially, there is an election underway in Newfoundland and Labrador, but what is your sense of how receptive both levels of government are likely to be here?
I think there is obviously some spotlight, we'll call on it right now. It's, I think from a federal level, you know, there is some interest. You know, we don't want to see, I don't think anybody wants to see these animals euthanized. It's finding the right spot for them. And I think there's possibility, you know, that they could be split up and it could be more cost effective. Obviously, not one party is going to be able to I'll say, afford to pay to take care of these animals for the next, you know, 20 to 50 years, right? So it's quite an endeavor.
Well, we've checked and we know that they've got your letter. They're not saying no.
No, they haven't said no. And I haven't had, I did email them back today to set up a time sometime this week to have a conversation and kind of see what the way forward could be, you know, and is Bergio a possibility for this? So
now, if Ottawa isn't willing to pay for all this, where else might the money come from?
We're kind of talking today with my town manager and stuff, and, you know, we looked at, you know, there are some third parties out there, you know, animal activist groups that would be interested. Possibly the hard part, I guess I'm going to say, is the length of time that it's going to be. This is not something that's going to be, you know, okay, well, we can pay for this for the next 5 years. You know, this could be a 20 to 50 year commitment, right? So it's a long-term commitment.
Well, and there is some question as to how long these animals could survive. I know you've said that even if the animals were to die, that you'd rather see them die in a place like Bergio. Is that right?
I feel like, myself personally, just humanely, I think I would rather see an animal die in its own natural surroundings than in a concrete swimming pool.
And what are residents of Bergio thinking about this idea of yours? What are you hearing from people?
They're actually quite perceptive of it. You know, they're shocked to hear that, you know, we even consider this. And it's just, you know, the town of Bergio, it was presented to us and we kind of thought, geez, you know, maybe we could be a solution to a problem here. And we hope that we can be. And like I said, there's a lot of stuff going on and a lot of, you know, we need some expert information and guidance along the way. So,
well, in the meantime, how much information do you even have about these whales and how they're doing, where they are right now?
My understanding is they are doing okay. I don't have a whole lot of information on how they are exactly right now. I do know we're like Marineland's had, since 2019, they've had 18 beluga whales die. So it's not a good situation where they're at. So humanely, I think it's the right thing to do to try to relocate these whales.
Well, lots of people watching, looking for solutions. Mayor Green, thank you.
Yes, I appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
Trevor Green is the mayor of Bergio, Newfoundland and Labrador. That's where we reached him. In a statement sent to us today by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, Minister Joanne Thompson said, quote, "Like many of you, I am angered that these whales have lived a life of captivity and as a result, their health has deteriorated," unquote. The minister also acknowledged that she'd received Bergio's correspondence and in a separate letter sent to Marineland earlier this month, affirmed that she remains open to new proposals and promises to review them, quote, "expeditiously." Hey.
about this girl. Maybe I should. I met her in Philly, and her name was Brown Sugar. See, we be making love.
From his debut album of the same name, this is Brown Sugar by D'Angelo, tempting listeners into wanting more with his soulful yet delicate voice, which he showcased throughout his music career. D'Angelo died today due to cancer, confirmed by his family. He was 51 years old. Since he entered the spotlight, thanks to songs like the one you're hearing, D'Angelo was critically acclaimed for being a pioneer of the neo-soul movement, alongside the likes of Lauryn Hill and Questlove and other collaborators, many of whom are describing D'Angelo today as a genius and legend. The attention he received, especially after his most popular album, Voodoo, was something D'Angelo famously struggled with, only releasing three albums since 1995. But every time he returned to the spotlight from seclusion, whether it be for a moving tribute for Prince on The Tonight Show in 2016 or for a surprise album release, it was always a big deal because fans always wanted more from D'Angelo. Nearly 15 years after his last album, D'Angelo returned with Black Messiah, which came out suddenly in 2014 when D'Angelo and his team fast-tracked its release, partly inspired by nationwide protests over the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and wanting to speak out through his music. From Black Messiah, here is D'Angelo with Another Life.
Listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Talia Schlanger. Thanks for listening.
I'm Dave Seglitz. Take care.